Welcome, everyone. I'm so glad that you joined us for our journey through the third option with Pastor Miles. A lot has happened over the past few months regarding race, so we wanted to take some time with you to help you unpack a lot of what you might be reading or hearing about in the public square. In this time of confusion, we need clear, biblical thinking more than ever. So today I'm going to invite you to come on a journey with us through the ancient letter of Ephesians, where we'll learn about God's surprising solution to some of the race problems they were facing. And then we'll address some popular answers that are finding their way into the church today, like critical race theory. This session is going to take a little bit longer than usual. There's a lot of important content to cover. So I hope you'll take a few notes and pause the video for breaks as you need to, so we give this complicated issue the attention that it deserves. I don't like to spend a lot of time reading directions. But when it seems pretty plain to me how to use a new tool, I just use it. I don't have a lot of patience for manuals. If you see the problem, have a tool, and it seems obvious how to use it, then why not just jump right in? Well, that's gotten me into some trouble. It probably would have helped if I read the instructions on the all-purpose caulking before adding a second layer to seal up some areas on our deck. Remove old caulking before applying. Instead of a nice, thick seal, I ended up with a rich, gooey mess. But at least my kids had fun playing with it. It also would have helped if I had read the manual for my power drill. The first four cutouts I drilled to string electrical cords through my shelving unit took me at least 20 minutes each. After learning about the torque control, the last one only took me a couple of minutes. But I imagine that my friends would have especially appreciated if I'd read the directions on the bear spray we bought in preparation for our camping trip. If only I would have known that it was a bad idea to test the bear spray at your campsite when there was no wind to carry it away. That made for a long night. When we see a problem, we want to fix it right away. That's especially true when the problems feel the most urgent. Have you ever found that your advice to a friend to try dating someone new right after a terrible breakup didn't land? Have you ever found that you had poor judgment after confronting a teacher for falsely accusing your child when the teacher was right all along? In that urgent desire to help a hurting friend or address some injustice, sometimes we leap before we look. Tragic racially charged encounters of the last year have uncovered a lot of that hurt and injustice that make us want to act or react very quickly. The racially charged events of the summer have left some reeling, confused, and feeling hopeless. Anger has reached a boiling point. Some have had enough and are demanding change. And it's left others feeling afraid that an anti-racist purge could go too far. They're suspicious of a narrative and tired of feeling manipulated. In our eagerness to try solutions or deny solutions, could it be that we're doing more harm? Here's what's at stake. And this is why I'm really glad that you've chosen to put some time aside to go with us on this journey toward racial understanding and unity. Many racial solutions suffer from a lack of moral clarity today. And in the vacuum of clear solutions, extreme voices take control of the conversation. If we're not careful about too quickly jumping onto the latest anti-racist trend, or if we're too eager to push back against anti-racist sentiment, we may alienate people we love, our family members, friends, classmates. We might damage trust with people that are different than us, coworkers, neighbors, clients. And those of us who consider ourselves to be followers of Jesus might send the wrong message about him too. Is it possible that God has given us something we can stand on with this tense topic, a principle we can live by and offer to the world that would keep us from leaping too early and give us the best possible opportunity to heal divisions instead of adding to the hostility? Is there a glimmer of hope that God has given us that can be a guiding light through the racial tensions we face today? That's the question I want to explore together. It just so happens that we aren't the first ones to struggle with racial and cultural tension. It wasn't quite like the struggle between races we talk about today, but it shared many of the common features. Two social and cultural groups with a shared history of division and oppression were at odds with each other in the newly formed Church of Jesus Christ. Jesus' followers were left with the task of navigating this thorny, volatile, and complex problem. That was especially the case for the missionaries who found themselves assembling Christian communities outside of Jerusalem and into a much more diverse world where Jews and non-Jews were struggling to coexist. It's in this conflict that we find Paul, who is one of the leaders of that early Jesus movement and a prolific writer of New Testament letters. Many scholars argue that the letter to the Ephesians was a circular letter that wasn't just to one group of Christians. One of the earliest manuscripts omits the address to the saints of Ephesus, and the letter lacks some of the personal notes that most of Paul's letters do. But whether it was written to a small church in what is now modern-day Turkey or written to many of them, the problem was the same: division. It's here where we find Paul admonishing followers of Jesus to make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace, telling them that there is only one body, or in other words, the church is one. He begins his letter by making a strong statement about the unique identity of this assembly, whom God has chosen to reveal his plan and lavish his goodness. And he closes his letter with a reminder that their battles are not against flesh and blood, but spiritual powers that are against them. Each one of those statements is worth an entire message on unity, but one word stands out in his letter on unity. Without it, unity cannot take off or stay on course. That word is grace. It's a foundational idea to all of Christian thought. Could it be that it is our best chance we have of addressing the racial tension yet? When many Christians think about grace, they think of forgiveness, and they're not wrong. But when early Christians used the word, it encompassed a lot more than that. Grace is simply a gift, some act of goodwill. When it's applied to God's relationship to mankind, it's a gift that's undeserved and unearned, and it manifests itself in all sorts of ways. Look how Paul frames it in Ephesians chapter 2. As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins in which you used to live when you followed the ways of this world and the ruler of the kingdom of the air, gratifying the cravings of your flesh and following its desires and thoughts. Like the rest, we were by nature deserving of wrath, but because of his great love for us, God, who is rich in his mercy, made us alive with Christ, even when we were dead in transgressions. It is by grace you have been saved. Paul continues the thought in verses 8 and 9. For it is by grace you have been saved, through faith, and this is not from yourselves. It is a gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. There's a lot to unpack here, but for our purposes, let me highlight a couple of points. When Paul says you were dead in your transgressions, he is talking about the former condition of his readers. But he's also talking about where we all come from. Merriam-Webster defines human nature in neutral terms, the fundamental dispositions and traits of humans. A writer from the San Francisco Chronicle used the term in a positive way. Everyone expects the downtown workers will eventually return, if for no other reason than human nature demands contact. But Paul had a much different concept of human nature. Left to ourselves, our baser desires wage war within us. We're dead in them. From an eternal point of view, it's like we're zombies. And if you've ever watched zombie movies, you know what needs to happen to zombies. But God looked on the walking dead with great love and mercy, and he did something wild. He extended an opportunity to us to become alive when we deserve something else. God offered beauty, texture, color to an otherwise lifeless existence. He demonstrated his desire to animate good desires within us that lay dormant and instill in us an ability to overcome the cravings of a shallow existence. It had to be done that way. Have you ever seen a zombie movie where the undead made themselves alive again? But even if in theory we could make ourselves alive, it would only give us a reason to be filled with pride, and not the good kind of pride. We'd compare ourselves with others. We'd see no need for God, and we'd distance ourselves from him. That's why Paul adds that critical aside. It is the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. That's great, you're thinking. But what does all this have to do with racial unity? How does God's gracious offer to make us alive when we were dead bring two conflicting groups together? Many people are familiar with the early part of Ephesians 2, but the way Paul applies it provides a powerful object lesson in corporate harmony. Paul continues by addressing the non-Jews or Gentiles in his audience, inviting them to remember that they became a part of a better identity that was never theirs to begin with. Paul says, "Remember that at that time, the time of your birth, you were separate from Christ, excluded from citizenship in Israel, and foreigners to the covenants of the promise, without hope and without God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, you who were once far away have been brought near by the blood of Christ. For he himself is our peace, who has made the two groups one and has destroyed the barrier, the dividing wall of hostility, by setting aside in his flesh the law with its commands and regulations. His purpose was to create in himself one new humanity out of the two, thus making peace, and in one body to reconcile both of them to God through the cross, by which he put to death their hostility." When I was a kid, there wasn't much to occupy myself on the long sales trips my sister and I would take with my dad, but he happened to have these large industrial magnets in his truck that I often found myself playing with. I remember especially being fascinated with the effect that it would create when I tried to force the same sides of two different magnets together. It was like an invisible blanket existed between the two, and no matter how hard I tried, and believe me, I tried, I just couldn't get two different magnets to touch that way. Jews and Gentiles had their own invisible force keeping them apart. Paul calls it the dividing wall of hostility. And there's a lot of discussion on exactly what Paul is referring to here. But for our purposes, what's important to know is that the death of Jesus destroyed the barrier. And in Jesus, the two conflicting groups took on a new and better identity. Under a new covenant or a new arrangement with God, both groups were made alive and had become one. Paul will go on to say, both have access to God now, and that the Gentiles are no longer foreigners and strangers, but fellow citizens with God's people, being built together to become a dwelling in which God lives by his Spirit. This might be news to us, but this would not have been news to them. This was theology 101 for the early church. They weren't hearing these basic truths for the first time, which is something that's often lost on us when we read some of these letters. They knew that they had taken on a new identity, and that identity bound together two distinct hostile groups with a history of oppression. But the fact of their union wasn't always enough to remove the edge between the two groups. Conflict would spring forth from time to time. Segregation was still happening. Sometimes even the leaders refused to eat a meal with people in the church who were on the other side. What's Paul trying to say? The key is the action step, remember. In this case, he's speaking to Gentiles, but if he were speaking to the Jews, he'd say something similar. He tells them to remember that once they were excluded from citizenship, the promises, the hope, and from God, they were utterly dead in their transgressions, but now they've been brought near, made alive, and not because of anything they did. Why would Paul want them to remember that? What value is there in thinking about their former state? And why would he want them to consider that what they were given wasn't something that they earned? Both Gentiles and Jews were coming to the table with an embedded sense of cultural superiority and wounds that came from oppression. Maybe it didn't come out in polite conversation. Perhaps it was only revealed when there was tension between a couple of them and a Gentile thought, greedy Jew, or a Jew let slip, stupid pagan. But the conflict was there, and this diverse assembly of early Christians whose coming together was nothing short of a miracle was starting to fracture. Is it possible that group conflict was being fueled by a strong sense of cultural superiority? Could tension over disparate resources and power have caused them to forget what they mutually shared in Christ? When we find ourselves in the middle of a conflict, it's natural to build up defense mechanisms that protect our fragile security. But Paul challenged all that by daring his readers to revisit the truth of God's undeserved, all-encompassing grace. Paul was giving them a path forward in their differences. And remembering God's undeserved, all-encompassing grace can give us a path forward in the racial conflict too. That's because God's grace invites groups to embrace their unworthiness and divine privilege. And the humility and gratefulness that result from that creates a genuine and lasting bond of peace. And that's why so many of the answers to racism are only making the problem worse. There's no instruction manual on the race problem. The racial tension that's stirring conflict at a societal level is complex. We need better creative policies. We need courageous voices to speak accurately and graciously. We need individuals to demonstrate kindness and the love of Christ in that space. But if we don't address some of the underlying causes of group hostility, our answers will only further dehumanize and dismiss people. Pride is just one of those causes. Pride makes us overlook the flaws of our own group and dismiss other groups by consciously or subconsciously fostering an attitude of superiority over them. Now, it's not wrong to feel positive about our culture, nor should we be afraid of showing humble thanks for our heritage and the advantages that might come with it. But when we become steeped in group pride, we have a tendency to ignore our own group's problems. Hard work, independence, and an entrepreneurial spirit have all been strong values in predominantly white Western culture. But is it possible that an improper emphasis on those values in American white culture can lead to minimizing relationships and disrespect for authority? Sin doesn't discriminate. It burrows itself in every group regardless of their values, and it has a way of disguising itself so that it's not easily recognizable. And even when we recognize it in our own people group, sin has a way of diminishing itself in competition and in comparison to others. Apart from the redeeming work of God, all groups come from the same place of darkness and hopelessness regardless of the values they hold. Maybe some of you think that that's going too far. Don't certain groups hold better values than others? Certainly all groups are not created equal. When there's a problem with an athletic team or a business, don't we talk about changing the culture? Absolutely. Some of the cultural values of some groups can be better than others. But having a positive culture doesn't make people eager or honest participants in its values. Paul pointed that out about the Jews in another one of his letters. The Gentiles thought they came from a better stock, and so did the Jews. The Jews thought of themselves as superior because they had the law and the covenants. Here's what Paul said to them. Now you, if you call yourself a Jew, if you rely on the law and boast in God, if you know his will and approve of what is superior because you are instructed by the law, if you are convinced that you are a guide for the blind, a light for those who are in the dark, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of little children, because you have in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth, you then who teach others, do you not teach yourself? You who preach against stealing, do you steal? You who say that people should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? God doesn't judge people based on how good their group's values are alone. He judges people based on what they do with good values. And that reality levels the playing field. All groups, apart from Christ, come from a place of spiritual emptiness. There's no superiority. One person wasn't born into a group that was less affected by sin than another. Group pride causes us to lose sight of our own group's problems and dismiss others. But an opportunity for real connection comes when we can admit that we all come from a desperate place. What would happen if, through the help of the Holy Spirit, we came to terms with the group pride that we often find so much security in? When we come to terms with sin as our shared birthright, will we be able to better see some of the unique beauty in other groups we've missed too? In February of 2018, the movie Black Panther hit theaters. It took a relatively unknown superhero and made him into a household name. The Black Panther was a king of Wakanda, a fictional country in Africa, which was secretly the wealthiest and most technologically advanced nation in the world. The idea was provocative, an African tribal culture mixed with hovering ships and invisibility shields. But Black Panther captured the attention of the world in a positive way. In 27 days, it became the highest grossing superhero movie ever made at the time. It was a cultural moment. It flipped a narrative on power. But it did all of that without abandoning some of the values that black culture already embodied, like kinship and loyalty. It put the best of black culture on display for the world to see by recontextualizing it in a story for everyone. What other beautiful features could the white world have missed from this group it often finds itself in tension with? Robert Hill identified several in an article in the Baltimore Sun. Achievement orientation, work ethic, flexible family roles, kinship bonds, and religious orientation. He goes on to cite statistics that support a rise, not decline, in multiple generations living in the same household, even as the involvement of the father declined. What has been dubbed kinship care had the lowest levels of child abuse. He also noted research that indicated black youth with strong religious commitments were those most likely to enjoy positive outcomes as an adult. And that's especially significant because blacks are far better at attending church than every other racial subgroup. The Pew Research Center concluded that blacks were 12% more likely to attend church weekly than whites. Black people attend church weekly nearly 10% more than the next highest ethnic group. They may be doing better than any cultural group at maintaining consistent commitments with their faith and passing that faith down to the next generation as a result. Sadly, many lose sight of those beautiful, even challenging qualities with all the racial tension we face today. When lines are drawn, we have a tendency to defend our own side. People who have been forced to wear a scarlet letter for some act of adultery, people who have been caught stealing, or people who have embarrassed their families over some public addiction. I've often found that some of the people who have come face to face with their sin are the most vulnerable and open to others who are different in sin as well. What would it be like if we came to terms with the sins of the group we identify with? What kind of surprising and beautiful connections might we make if we truly saw that we were coming from the same place? When we remember where we came from, there's no reason for boasting. That leaves more room for connection. Coming to terms with our own unworthiness opens up surprise doors to connect with others through humility. But pride isn't the only underlying cause of group hostility. Envy is too. Envy causes us to look at the disparities between groups and dehumanize those groups by viewing them through a have-have-not relationship. That's important because we know that an inequality in material possessions or power and influence can so easily influence our relationships on a personal level. Some of us might tend to look at wealthy people with spite. Others might struggle not to treat well-known people with favoritism. Either way, we end up objectifying the person on the other end. Isn't it possible that the same dynamic could occur on a group level too? A couple of years ago, I got the chance to spend some time with a black intern at one of our local churches. I learned a bit about his time in Georgia over lunch one day, and we connected immediately over college football. A couple of months later, we attended a conference together. It would be the last time I'd see him. His internship was wrapping up, and he would be returning to school. But our last conversation would be one I'd remember. Somehow the topic of race came up, and he started talking to me about privilege, more specifically white privilege. He told me that privilege, an advantage that I had and that he didn't, was evil. That wasn't something that anybody had ever said to me before, but I was curious, especially since it came from someone who was training to be a future pastor. Immediately, James chapter 1 came to mind. So I asked him, if privilege of any kind is evil or bad, what do you think it means when James says, "Don't be deceived, my dear brothers and sisters. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows." My friend's face twisted into a puzzled look, and he stared at the ground. It took him longer to say something than I would have expected. It clearly threw him. "I don't know," he said. And that was the strange end to the last conversation we would have. I didn't know it at the time, but I was encountering something that I learned a lot more about this past summer, which has recently exploded onto the national scene over the last month. It's called critical race theory. It's been made fashionable in popular circles by books such as Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility, and it's beginning to take a prominent place in the church as well. Apologist Neil Shenvey has defined critical theory as a view of reality through the lens of power, dividing people into oppressed groups and oppressor groups along various axes like race, class, gender, sexuality, physical ability, and age. Chances are a lot of you have never heard of the phrase critical theory, but maybe you've encountered some of the ideas around it as you've watched the news or your news feed. Critical theory holds that oppression is embedded in the very cultural systems we operate under. Consequently, those systems need to be entirely dismantled. It also holds that oppressed peoples are better able to grasp moral truth because of their personal lived experience under oppression. Intersectionality is a term you may have heard that's often associated with it. Someone is never just a part of one group. From the perspective of contemporary critical theory, someone might be a part of several disadvantaged groups. And the more oppressed groups a person can claim to be a part of, the more moral authority they have. Does contemporary critical theory have any positive contributions to make to our thinking? Are there ways that it might overlap with Christian thought? Absolutely. The Bible not only recognizes oppression, it acknowledges oppressed people groups. The Jews were slaves to the Egyptians. The Jews were subjugated under Rome. And Christians were persecuted by both Jews and the Romans. Furthermore, Christians have long recognized the existence of social or political power over entire systems. Some might think of Hollywood as being one example of a system exercising some negative influence over society and culture. Sometimes it's not just an individual or a small group of individuals at the top who are using their influence for wrong goals. Sometimes there is an entire subculture that promotes bad values. Yet there are two things about critical theory that might prove problematic with the way of Jesus. Now, critical race theory claims that oppressed people are in a better position for understanding moral truth. And critical race theory says individuals within a group assume the guilt and responsibility for the entirety of their group. Let's consider each point, starting with the first. On the surface, it makes sense that those who are oppressed might have better insight into moral truth. If oppressors had the same insight, wouldn't they stop abusing those without power? And doesn't the experience of oppression make one more sensitive towards others who might be abused? But is all power abused? And is power bad simply because it's had? It's true that in one way, Jesus flipped the narrative on power. In Mark chapter 10, verses 42 through 45, he responded to the indignant envy among the disciples by saying, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be the first must be a slave to all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many." Jesus flipped the narrative on power. But this isn't what critical race theorists are calling for at all. They call for equality of power, not submitting oneself underneath the power of another person. And even this was temporary for Jesus. Just a few breaths earlier, he said, "Many who are first will be last, and the last first." That's because power should be had by the kind of people that don't consider their interests to be more important than others. But isn't the powerless society a myth anyways? People might codify equality of power into law, but who determines the code? Who enforces it? When it's been tried all over the world, the real power under powerless society always seems to be held by oppressive oligarchies. And the product is worse than the one that started. The truth is that even the oppressed are subject to bias. A woman who has had a couple of negative experiences with men might conclude that all men are the same. So who should we trust? When the Jews and Gentiles battled back and forth over it, Paul said that divine truth was not grounded simply in signs, as the Jews said, or simply in wisdom, as the Gentiles said, but in the cross of Christ. That confounded both of them because death via crucifixion was weakness to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. The point is that no group has a corner on the market of truth. every group has self-preservation as a central interest. And self-preservation has a tendency to bend or ignore the truth in its favor. But the cross symbolizes the opposite of self-preservation, which is why it was so counterintuitive to every culture it encountered. The truth, like sin, does not discriminate based on one's race or ethnicity. Critical race theorists argue that the oppressed have better insight into moral truth, and they also argue that individuals within a group assume the guilt of and responsibility for the entirety of their group. That means that if some white people have oppressed black people, then all white people bear responsibility. They should acknowledge and learn about their oppressive behaviors, and they should divest themselves of that power. Some have gone so far as to include ancestors like slaveholders in the group and to suggest reparations as a way of offering financial restitution for the wrongs committed in previous generations. Followers of Jesus do have a moral responsibility to care for and address sin in their midst. The church at the city of Corinth suffered greatly when they gave their approval to a terrible extramarital affair happening there. And followers of Jesus should make restitution for wrongs that they have personally committed. When Jesus encountered the tax collector Zacchaeus, he responded to Jesus by saying, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount." Zacchaeus didn't just say that he was sorry or that he felt bad about what he did. He corrected his wrong that he was responsible for, and Jesus affirmed him. But am I both guilty and responsible for the sins of a previous generation? It turns out that the answer is a little complicated. For instance, if a son inherited a fortune from a father that he later learned was built off of sex trafficking, we would commend that son for relinquishing that fortune to help the victims of sex trafficking. On the other hand, would we expect that son to serve his father's sentence? If he had spent a portion of that inheritance on basic needs, would we expect him to go into bankruptcy to give away the full sum? Let's put reparations aside for the moment. What about a formal apology for the sins of past generations? The Southern Baptist Church, America's second largest denomination, issued a formal apology in the 1990s over the positive positions towards slavery it held in the past. If an institution celebrates and benefits from a positive legacy, it makes practical sense to acknowledge and repent from a negative one as well. But does one Christian group apologize for the sins of another? Do Baptists apologize for Lutherans? Do Catholics repent for the Greek Orthodox? Should followers of Jesus everywhere today be lamenting the Crusades? Modern critical theorists subtly frame a lot of guilt and responsibility in terms of white privilege today. The black experience in America in general is a disadvantaged one in comparison to the average white person. People might disagree why that is. They might disagree with the extent. But most people can accept that some disadvantage exists. Even still, white privilege is not a neutral way of describing it. Why name something that describes the difficulties one group experiences by the difficulties another group does not? Calling it white privilege assumes some complicity. You may have never committed any racist act, but if you are a white person, critical race theorists say you benefit from a system that has been built on racism. And white people should be held responsible as a result. Some well-respected Bible teachers have weighed in on this idea of group responsibility and complicity. They argue that the Bible makes a clear case for corporate responsibility. The sin of some in a group becomes the responsibility of everyone in that group. It's not entirely without basis. When Achan sinned in the book of Joshua, the whole camp of Israel was held responsible. When the prophet Daniel prayed for forgiveness of sins in Daniel 9, he prayed that the sins of the entire nation would be forgiven too. Moses said in Exodus 34:7 that God does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation. There is even evidence that these rules apply to nations outside of the covenant. But is it possible that God... Is it possible that that changed under God's grace? I was curious whether a deeper look might tell us more, and it turns out that the prophet Jeremiah promised that a time would come when new covenant people would no longer be held under this old covenant burden. In those days, people will no longer say the parents have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. Instead, everyone will die for their own sin. Whoever eats sour grapes, their own teeth will be set on edge. What Jeremiah is saying is that people would no longer be held accountable for their ancestors, for what their ancestors did before them. Is it possible that he envisioned the cross, where in one final act of corporate guilt, the sins of the world were placed on Jesus to bear? The new covenant under Jesus didn't abolish our responsibility to care for one another out of a debt of love, but it did remove the debt we had to pay on behalf of other people. So what's that mean for us? We can pray that God will forgive people just as Jesus did on the cross, but we cannot repent on their behalf. When the leaders of the Southern Baptist Church rightly repented for their involvement in slavery in generations past, they did so to clear the legacy of an organization that transcended generations, not to clear the consciences of the individuals who actually practiced it long ago. We can offer assistance and support other groups who seek it. Go another mile with the one who asks, like Jesus taught. But we cannot pay for the sins of our fathers, as if God's grace was not sufficient. Finally, we can and should mourn for the sin of our group and take steps to remove it from our midst. It's our sin if we don't, because God has given us the responsibility, but we cannot be punished for the sin of someone else. If we assign blame on individuals based upon their group identity or ancestry, the blame will never end for anyone. If I had to carry the weight of every sin a male has ever committed, I'd have half the weight of the world on my shoulders. But God's grace frees us from all that. It treats us as individuals, even as it binds us together in a new community. There's a lot more that could be said about critical race theory, including its tendency to dismiss all critiques as evidence of white supremacy, and its demand that people speak out on racism as a way of divesting oneself of one's whiteness. All of this only further fosters a spirit of divisiveness, but let's not lose sight of the core. At its heart, critical race theory dehumanizes both black and white people by viewing them only through their relationship with power. It may have good intentions in trying to dismantle what it sees as evil systems, but in failing to see people beyond groups who have power and who do not, it falls into the same trap it's trying to address by stereotyping the group in power and victimizing the group that's not. John McWhorter calls it deeply condescending to all proud black people in his response to D'Angelo's White Fragility in the Atlantic. He goes on without pulling punches. In 2020, as opposed to 1920, I neither need nor want anyone to muse on how whiteness privileges them over me. Nor do I need wider society to undergo teachings in how to be exquisitely sensitive about my feelings. I cannot imagine that any black readers could willingly submit themselves to these ideas while considering themselves adults of ordinary self-regard and strength. And yet, where critical race theory falls short, the grace of God steps in. Not only does the grace of God invite us to humbly remember that we all come from the same bad place, it reminds us that we have gained access to every lasting, good, and beautiful thing through Jesus. We have hope for a future beyond this world. We have the promise of prosperity and no more tears. We have a new eternal community to enjoy, and God has given us access to Him. What earthly disparity can compare to the eternal rewards every race and nation will one day share? Can you imagine what would happen if groups of people who might have disparate power and resources focused wholeheartedly on these eternal rewards instead? If followers of Jesus fully embraced the security that they have in Him, what kind of unity might we enjoy without having to view our individual or group relationships with one another through the lens of have and have not? The Bible has plenty to say about greed, generosity, and helping the poor. A call to gratefulness should be no excuse to deny help to people who are different than us when they are facing real needs, such as a lack of employment, housing, and food. But if we fall into the trap of thinking that equal dignity cannot be achieved in this world unless everyone has the exact same stuff or power will only foster more division. As they are able, followers of Jesus should strive to contribute to fair and just societies for everyone. But fair and just structures don't make racial disparities and conflicts disappear. It may take on different forms, but the world will continue to struggle with racial and ethnic conflict as long as there are racial and ethnic groups, because pride and envy always finds a way in. But God has given us a better vision. In the final book of the Bible, an angel shares a spectacular picture of eternity with the Apostle John. After this I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. They were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands. And they cried out in a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." That's an image of unity if I've ever seen one. God never created human beings to look the same or to sound the same. His ultimate plan includes every kind of person from every culture and place. It's a remarkable picture of humanity in its fullness. But in order to achieve that there, we have to come to terms with grace here. Will we dismiss the beauty of other groups and struggles of our own in pride? Or in humility, will we consider that our culture and heritage gives us no better advantage before God? Will we reduce racial problems to struggles over power in our envy? Or in our gratefulness for what we've been given, will we resist the urge to judge groups of people by what they have? Friends, we can do better by calling our attention to some of the ways we subconsciously think our group is better, considering our own flaws and sin nature, and by refusing to view people by what they have. We have nothing to boast about, but we have every reason to boast in God. And what he's provided for us, he's provided for every group as well. By sticking to these eternal perspectives, we'll be able to speak truth into our relationships, be agents of healing in racial conflict, and demonstrate the light and goodness of Jesus to a world that desperately needs him. It's not a quick solution, but it works.